Welcome to Nancy's Bookshelf, a program of conversation and readings with local and regional writers. Now, here's your host, Nancy Wigman.
Today's two guests collaborated on a locally popular field guide to the birds of Bidwell Park. They have now expanded this book, their new edition, The Birds of Bidwell Park. Retired Professor Roger Lederer taught ornithology and ecology at Chico State University and served as Dean of the College of Natural Sciences for 10 years. He has birdwatched in over 100 countries and lectured on numerous cruise ships. He has presented hundreds of public presentations to a wide variety of audiences, and through his website, ornithology.com, has been a resource for the BBC, National Geographic, National Public Radio, Canadian Television, Vanity Fair, the Guinness Book of World Records, and many other organizations. Professor Lederer has published 30 scientific papers and 8 books. His most recent book is Beaks, Bones, and Birdsongs. Roger Lederer, welcome.
Thank you.
The illustrator for the Birds of Bidwell Park is retired Professor Carol Burr. She taught literature at California State University, Chico, served as department chair, created the honors program, and directed the Center for Multicultural and Gender Studies. She edited and published Unstill Lives, Women of Northern California, and Feeling for Place. She has worked in oil, watercolor, and charcoal. She drew the birds and symbols of the Birds of Bidwell Park using pen and pencil. She's involved in many local organizations, such as the League of Women Voters, Soroptimist International, the Discovery Shop, and is the longest-serving member, over 20 years, of Bidwell Park's Watch Program. Carol Burr, welcome.
Thank you.
Well, you believe in taking care of the park, obviously, if you've been a member of Bidwell Park's Watch Program for over 20 years.
Yeah, I got in fairly early. It's 20 years now, but it's a group of volunteers that come in, and we go through a training process, and we learn the rules of the park, and then we also clean up litter, and just our face of the park. We wear our little vests, and we have no police function, obviously, sort of an educational and a cleanup function, which is something we really care about in the park, and we also did that Make a Difference Day. We cleaned up in the park as well with that as part of Park Watch, and it fits in with everything that we've done, sort of with the book and with our careers.
Well, a lot of us appreciate the fact that Annie Bidwell is the person responsible for this wonderful attraction, this wonderful asset. The community of Chico.
Absolutely.
In fact, you dedicate the book to Annie Bidwell.
Yeah, she understood, I think, the importance of open space. And to have 4,000 acres as a city park is pretty spectacular. And it's a beautiful park. It's under a lot of pressure because we all want to use it. So I think part of what she was trying to do by saying no alcohol and some of the other rules that she created for it were so that everyone could enjoy it generation after generation. So we feel she was kind of a founding mother in many, many ways, but the park is one of the main ones, and she really understood stewardship. And so you love something, but you try not to love it to death, I guess.
Well, we all are grateful to Annie Bidwell for that. So you dedicate your book to Annie. What was the inspiration for this collaboration?
Well, I think for years I've been trying to figure out a way to collaborate with my husband.
Roger Lederer is your husband.
Oh, yes, by the way. that's sort of how I got to be the artist, because it was, you know, kind of sitting on the sofa to figuring out how we were going to get the book illustrated. But I've been looking for something like this, and even though illustrating a bird book was not what I had thought of, I don't think I ever would have come up with that on my own. I'm not even sure that I quite survived doing this thing. You know, it was really something different for me. But it's kind of interesting when the humanities and the sciences get together.
Well, you are the illustrator, but there is one illustration that is not yours. All the rest of the illustrations you did.
That's true.
Who was the, may I call her the guest illustrator?
I think that's appropriate. She's also the legacy because she's our granddaughter, and Olivia Calvin, and she is quite a little artist herself. We started drawing together when she was very, very young, And I think I credit her to some extent with my even considering doing some of the drawing for the book, because she, you know, when you're with a little person and you're trying to find something interesting to do, that's what you do. And we just had such a good time together. And she is the next generation, and we want the park to be there for her and all the Olivias out there.
My guests are Carol Burr and Roger Lederer, and they one of the first pages of your book is an illustration by your granddaughter, Olivia.
Yeah.
How old was she when she did that illustration? Because it's quite nice.
She was nine.
Nine years old.
Yeah.
And already a published illustrator.
Oh, and she's very proud of it. She likes to show every time we bring the book out. She says, you know, here I am.
Yeah. Well, I was looking at your original edition, your first edition, and your new edition to see, well, in what way did you expand this book? And I noticed that in the back of the book, you have other birds you might see. And in the original edition, you had you changed it, in other words, from the first edition to the newer edition.
Mm-hmm.
And in what ways did you change the birds you might see?
Well, I
did
think
you add to it? Did
yes.
you subtract from it?
We didn't subtract because the birds that we have in there are the ones you're still likely to see. But we added five additional birds that have become really much more common in the park. I mean, you might see them rarely, but now we're seeing them much more commonly.
Well, I wondered, too, if you got feedback from local residents who said, hey, Carol, I see a lot of this bird. Or did you just on your own see these?
I would say it's more on our own, wouldn't you, that we just...
We did. We've given a lot of bird walks over the years to, for the Snow Goose Festival and for other events. And people point out, well, I saw this or I saw that. But on our field trips, and it was probably, certainly dozens, maybe 100 field trips that we've taken people out, there's only been three birds that people observe during our field trips that aren't in the book. And they've only been observed once. We put one of them in. That's the great egret. We saw a great egret. And that wasn't even in the park. It just flew over. But somebody wanted to make a point. You don't have that in your book.
Well, I did notice that you included more in your descriptions. You had more birds. In the first edition, you had 86 species described.
Mm-hmm.
And in your 2017 edition, you have 91 species described.
Yes.
So that meant you did some more illustrations, Carol.
Yes, I did five more. I did the, as he mentioned, the great egret, which flew over. We did a downy woodpecker, and we have seen some of those, but they're not really very common. A Nashville warbler, a phainopepla, which is the common name and the official name are the same, and the Eurasian colored dove. This one that arrived in Chico around 2007 or so and has proliferated. And now they're just everywhere, making that very distinctive call that they have.
Maybe we could also mention from one edition to the next, since you used a local publisher.
Very much so. We're delighted with Heidelberg Press. And Larry Jackson took extremely good care of us, because it took a lot of sort of, rearranging of the book with the addition of the birds, and we also redid all the text. And so it was a big project for him, and he did a beautiful job.
He did, and I looked at what we gave him and his setup, and I thought I felt sorry for him, actually, because this is going to be a lot of work, but he was just so good at it. He caught all kinds of things, and he had to rejigger all the page numbers and all that stuff, and he did it with aplomb. He was great.
Yes, and he actually seemed to enjoy it.
Well, speaking of enjoying, I thoroughly enjoy, Roger, your lectures that I've been to. They are just so fascinating and captivating, particularly, I'm sure people who know a lot about birds enjoy them, but I learned so much. And one thing that people sometimes wonder about, how are animals different from humans? And in the case, since we're talking about birds, I like the quote by Robert Lind that you included in your book. Do you remember what he said about how birds differ from man?
Yeah, birds can have their environment and not destroy it, something like that.
Yeah, he says, there's nothing in which the birds differ more from man. Now, people might say, well, birds can't talk. or that's a difference. But so there's nothing in which birds differ more from man than the way in which they can build and yet leave a landscape as it was before.
Hmm. Right. Everything recycles in their world.
There you go. Native Americans understood that.
Yeah.
And I think we're realizing that if we don't figure it out pretty quickly, we are going to be not doing very well, because the animals, and of course we're animals too, but we seem to be doing a bad job with the other animals. Yeah.
My guests are Roger Lederer. He's an ornithologist and author of 8 books and many scientific papers, and Carol Burr, whose skills with English language come in handy. You had a previous book, Latin for Bird Lovers, and the two of you collaborated on that book, which was fascinating. For example, speaking of where names for birds come from, I somehow, even though I know the Greek word os is bone, because we have all these English words that we've taken from the Greek, I never thought about an osprey as being related to the Greek word for bone. And how did that come about? Why is an osprey called?
Bone breaker.
Bone breaker, yeah.
Well, yeah, they only eat fish. And, you know, they grab a fish and pull it up to its nest and then tear it apart. And there's all kinds of bones at the bottom of the nest, and that could be where it came from. And ospreys are found all over the world. So a lot of people had different names for them. But the basic Greek name, osprey, is what they're stuck with.
And you mentioned they're eating fish. They're very successful fishermen, fisher birds. You say that 30% of the time they catch a fish.
Right, one of every three times. I showed one movie in the, I taught an OLLI course, you know, the OSHA lifelong learning thing last spring, and there was, I showed one clip of an osprey, and he was fighting with a fish. He was actually in the water, and for about 2 minutes you couldn't see anything but the bird on top of the water and some kind of fish underneath. He finally gets up with what looked like a 5-pound trout. It was incredible.
Yeah.
Well, he's also successful because he's very clever in how he fishes.
Oh, you mean how he carries the fish once he has it in the air, which I think is quite striking, that ability to rotate that toe so he has a two in the front and two in the back. Huh?
Yeah, because we assume, I guess, if we don't pay attention, that all birds' feet look alike. And you mentioned that some birds, their talons, they differ from one another according to what they need. Mm-hmm. When they're in their environment. Now, since the very first illustration in your book is of a woodpecker, your granddaughter, Olivia Calvin, did this illustration of an acorn woodpecker. Mm-hmm. And woodpeckers I find fascinating. There are all sorts of interesting facts you include about woodpeckers. For example, if they're pecking on a tree, tree trunk, you mentioned, Carol, the talons, and you think, well, most birds, they sit on a perch that's horizontal, but there's that woodpecker. His perch is vertical. Mm-hmm. So how does he manage that?
Well, he's got two toes in front and two toes in back, and then he leans back against his tail feathers, which are real stiff, very stiff tail feathers, and just lean back and pry themselves against the tail feathers and pound. And they can pound into a tree with 1,200 G's of force. Imagine 1,200 G's of force. I mean, astronauts maybe undergo 3 or 4 G's. I mean, that's 1,200 times the force of gravity. And they can do that by just leaning against their feathers and hanging on with their feet.
I didn't remember that particular figure in your book. You may not have included. I do remember the toes and the tail he uses, but my goodness.
I may not have put all that in there because there's an awful lot of woodpeckers.
And you're very concise. I love that about your book. It is very concise. When you're reading about the woodpecker, each bird is about a page. So you squeeze in a lot of information.
The hardest part of writing this book is just trying to figure out what the most interesting things are in the shortest number of words.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So I think in that regard, your task was maybe harder than Carol's, because she says, okay, I'm just going to illustrate the male of each of these species.
No, she had the harder job. There were days she was sitting on the couch drawing. What was that? There was the red shoulder hawk, and I thought we're going to have to commit her.
That was a tough one. Yeah, but it's okay. But I mean, I think what we found when we went back too is to just to make things as pellucidly clear as possible so that you can get in there and you know, have 10 sentences or 20 sentences and feel as though, okay, I really feel like I've got a better handle on identifying the bird I just saw.
And you mentioned that this is a guide for beginners, really, that if people want more information, there are other sources, other guidebooks. So yes. I think if I were reading along about this woodpecker, think, my gosh, woodpeckers are so interesting, I'm going to go to other resources and learn more about the woodpecker. Well, the fact that woodpeckers, this tremendous force that you described, Roger, why don't they give themselves a concussion?
Well, three things. One is that their jaws, their lower jaw, acts a little bit like a shock absorber. It springs back and forth, so that absorbs some of the shock. Secondly, their brain case is a lot like a sponge, and so it moves around and absorbs some of that shock. And the third thing is they have a tongue bone that wraps around the top of their head, and the tongue bone acts like a safety belt. Keep their head from moving back so far. In fact, they've invented tank helmets for tank drivers and bicycle helmets based on the woodpecker skull. And they've just invented something not on the market yet, but a collar for football players to prevent their neck from snapping back.
So it
all based on the woodpecker.
That really is amazing. These adaptations that this particular bird has. You mentioned this special mechanism, their jaw, and the fact their toes have adapted to how they need to be perched on and their stiff tail feathers. But then also, if a human were working close with wood like that and chips are flying, we'd have to have goggles or a mask. And a woodpecker doesn't have that. What does he have to keep from breathing in
wood chips?
Well, they've got little
bristles over their nose and near their eyes to keep wood chips from hitting their eyes.
So they have their own
little masks, sort of,
to protect them. So they can hold themselves in place with their toes and their tail. And there's another thing that they have to protect themselves from besides the wood chips, and that's parasites. How do they protect themselves from parasites?
Well, it's not only woodpeckers, but a lot of
flickers
do it. A lot of birds do that, too, is they just sit on an anthill, and the ants will crawl all over them. And I've got some pictures, some movies of a robin doing this. And he just spreads his wings out, ants crawl all over him. And then they crush the ants in their feathers after the ants get all over him. That puts the formic acid from the ants onto their feathers, which presumably keeps away bugs, mites and ticks and things like that.
Yeah. My guests are ornithologist Roger Lederer and illustrator and English professor, retired, they're both retired, Carol Burr. And they've collaborated on I'm going to call it a field guide for beginners. Is that okay? The Birds of Bidwell Park. And they have a new expanded edition that is out. So I wanted to talk to them about this new edition. A bird that we can recognize when we see it circling overhead, those of us who don't know much about birds, and we see these birds circling overhead, and we think, oh, there must be something dead. And you say no. That's not why vultures circle.
No, when the vultures are circling around, and they do that this time of year, especially when they're migrating, they'll find an air current and they rest by circling around. And they may be looking for food, but if there were dead food down there and they smelled it, they'd be down there. They wouldn't be circling around. And a common term for this vultures circling around as if they're being stirred is a kettle of vultures. Uh-huh. I think it's an interesting term. But, yeah people think, oh, yeah, there's something dead down there. No, they're dead down there. You wouldn't see them circling.
They'd be down there feasting. Well, if they feast on something like a dead skunk and a predator comes along, they've got a full stomach. What did they do?
They throw up. And that's why their name is Cathartes. For the word, you know, catharsis, to throw up. But some people say it's catharsis. It's not because they throw up when they get frightened and have been eating a big meal and can't take off, but because they clean the environment. So they clean the environment of various kinds of dead things.
So we owe a debt of gratitude to vultures.
Absolutely.
It is interesting, though, that we assume it's because of the dead animal, but as you say, they're circling because of the conditions are right for soaring.
Right.
And so if they find a dead animal, down they go. The vultures are not the prettiest bird I've ever seen.
No.
Well, having no feathers on their heads gives them kind of a homely look. But since they have their heads in mushy-gushy guts of things, it's better that they do not have feathers, because then they'd really have some problem with parasites probably. So it's a way to stay clean, sort of.
So vultures are unattractive, but it's a function of the fact that they've got their head in.
They have redeeming qualities.
They have many redeeming qualities.
Yeah. Well, there's so many interesting things about these birds that you tell us, that we see them as having distinct personalities. And that's what I really enjoyed about your book. My gosh, look at this bird. For example, I love watching crows because I think they probably, if we were to give a prize for the smartest bird, I think a crow would be a candidate for that.
Absolutely.
Just from what I know about crows.
All of them in the crow family. Crows,
jays.
Ravens, jays, mm-hmm. nutcrackers.
Yeah.
Because I've sometimes wondered about the difference in a raven and a crow, because Edgar Allan Poe didn't write the crow, he wrote the raven.
Right.
Well, ravens are bigger. I mean, they're about a third bigger, and they have more, the heavier bill.
Much
and they
heavier.
Have more, their nostrils are covered by hairs that are much heavier. They're just sort of more ominous looking, I think, if, you know.
They also have a little.
If he wrote The Crow, it wouldn't be as famous as the raven.
Quote The Crow,
quote
nevermore.
Quote The Crow, yeah, exactly.
But they do also have a beard, sort of a beard.
The raven. Beard.
The raven does, yeah. Yes.
Well, the crow itself is such a large bird that it's hard to imagine a bigger bird of that sort, the raven, as you're describing it.
Mm-hmm.
Well, there's a bird that I thought, well, gosh, that sounds pretty dumb, and that's the brown towhee, because he attacks his own reflection.
Well, a lot of birds do that, and especially in the springtime, I get emails from people saying, I've got cardinals, it's mostly cardinals, bluebirds, robins, but a lot of birds will attack their reflection in a rearview mirror or in your house, you know, anything like that. They just think it's a competitor, and so they charge it. And they keep hitting the window and can't seem to learn it's them.
Yeah. They're actually trying to make windows so that the birds do not see their reflection, because a lot of birds actually have killed themselves by running into windows. Yeah.
Yeah. So. Yeah, that makes me sad when I see a bird. Most of them, they're just stunned.
Right.
And they, after a little bit, they get up and can fly away. And so the crow, we often see on PBS documentaries about crows and how clever they are with tools. But there's also, you say the green heron uses bait when they fish.
Yeah.
Yeah, a couple herons do that, and I think a couple of other birds do too. They just hold a piece of whatever it happens to be, drop it in the water, and some fish come to it. We were in, where were we? Someplace off the coast of West Africa one time and watching this black hawk. And he was circling around. He was dropping things in the water, and I couldn't figure out what he was doing. He was dropping twigs. He'd come down and grab twigs and then fly up in the air and drop the twigs. Well, there were fish coming to the twigs there, and once in a while he'd drop down to catch a fish.
Yeah.
But he just used twigs. The fish didn't know any better. They'd just take a look, and all of a sudden it was too late.
My guests are ornithologist Roger Lederer and retired English professor Carol Burr, who was the illustrator of their book, The Birds of Bidwell Park. There's, I think, as fashions come and go, I think we can kind of thank the fact that it went out of fashion to put feathers on a hat.
Yeah, in fact, the great egret that we added in the expanded version, that and the other sort of herons and that sort of thing almost were taken down to extinction by the feather trade, huge feather trade, late 19th, early 20th century. And they were just killing these birds by the thousands for their feathers. It was pretty bad. And finally they passed a law, so preventing that. So,
well, also the I don't know that we eat that bird, but we eat ducks. And the wood duck was hunted for food and for its feathers, and fortunately we quit wearing feathers on our hats for their sake. So
yeah, I think that's the thing. I mean, for a while it seemed as though people were just sort of shooting them, assuming there was no end to the number. And I think that's what's really changed, is our recognition that we have driven my birds really very close to and critically endangered. What did you tell me? 40% loss of songbirds in the last,
40 years.
Wow. So we're seeing a huge depredation of the birds, and it's a loss of habitat, you know, loss of food. Climate change, to some extent, they come at certain times of the year expecting food to be there, and if the climate change has sort of changed that made it come in earlier or later or whatever, then they struggle with that.
Well, I think books like yours raise our awareness of what we're doing to the birds and the fact that they are such an asset to our way of life that we do need to take care of them. And I think maybe the baby boomers are leading the way to bird watching, because a friend of mine here in town said that bird watching is perfect for baby boomers because it's easier on the knees.
I haven't thought about that
part.
No,
we haven't.
But yeah, that's part of the book. Part of the reason for the book is to get people interested in birds. When people are interested in birds, it's sort of they're opening the door to nature, to appreciating what's out there. So the people may have been totally out of contact with nature over their life, and then they start to get a little older, look for vocations that they don't have to, you know, not doing extreme skiing anymore. So they start looking at birds, and the birds show them other kinds of things, and so they appreciate nature that they hadn't before.
Well, I know that I am constantly amazed in reading your book at the things I did not know about birds. And they're around us all the time. Mm. And I was kind of astounded at my lack of awareness of the birds. Now, I do recognize the scrub jays because they are so ubiquitous. And their screech, I won't call it a bird song, is distinctive.
It's not very pretty.
Not quite a song. Same thing with the crows. Crows are songbirds, but not really.
No.
They're a different group of songbirds, but they're officially songbirds.
Not a pretty call.
Do you run into people calling the scrub jays blue jays?
Oh, yeah. Blue jays and then the acorn woodpecker, red-headed woodpeckers.
Yeah, because he does have a red head. The acorn woodpecker has a red head.
And so do all other woodpeckers.
Yeah.
So I was just back east. I was in Florida last week, and I saw the real red-headed woodpecker back there and the red-bellied woodpecker and the fish crow, things we don't have out here, but... So they have all official common English names. It's the only group of animals or only group of organisms in the world that have official English names, all 10,000 species of them. So we call the blue jay, it's wrong because, one, it's not the right name. Two, there is a bird named the blue jay already. So I try and point that out to people. There are official names.
I think when you have people who sort of come to California from the East Coast and they have a bird that sort of looks like what they're seeing out here, so then they keep bringing the blue jay with them, even though that's not really what they're seeing. But it's not a terrible error, I guess.
Well, but it makes us take a closer look.
Very much
if
so.
If we realize, a blue jay and a scrub jay are not the same bird.
Right. No. And that's why I think having a book that just has the birds that you're likely to see sitting at the window of your, you know, where you're having breakfast or going out for a walk, this is a good place to start, I think.
And you don't need binoculars. In my neighborhood, there was a while that magpies congregated out in front of my house, and I just loved watching them. I didn't need binoculars, and I just wondered about the personalities of these birds that were beautiful.
They are
I find
beautiful.
Them really pretty. And to watch them strut around. But I don't see them now. They either found some other place than my neighborhood or they're less common here.
Yes, well, I think they were affected, the magpies.
We had a lot of magpies in our backyard for several years, too, and then they disappeared. It was West Nile virus.
West Nile. Yeah.
Crows and magpies, almost 100% mortality. Magpies are just starting to come back now. They have been coming back the last couple of years, but then not to the extent where they were before.
Yeah, and
there is hope that they might visit.
Oh, I think so. And we, you know, for a while we lost sight of the quail, and I think it's partly because of the feral cats and because they're ground nesting, and so, yeah.
My guests are Roger Lederer, he's an ornithologist and author, and Carol Burr, also an author and illustrator. And we're going to take a short break, and when we come back, I want to ask you some more about the birds that are in your book. And remind people that you're listening to Nancy's Bookshelf on North State Public Radio. I'm Nancy Wiegman. I'm Nancy Wiegman, and you're listening to Nancy's Bookshelf on North State Public Radio. And my two authors have distinguished themselves in their various careers. Roger Lederer taught ornithology and ecology at Chico State University. He's consulted for government agencies, has given public presentations and lectures on cruise lines, and through his website, ornithology.com, has served as a resource for the BBC, National Geographic, National Public Radio, and Guinness Book of World Records. And Carol Burr is a retired English professor who illustrated the birds of Bidwell Park and is an author also. They collaborated on Latin for Bird Lovers as their last book, but their new book is an expanded edition of The Birds of Bidwell Park. Since you did this new edition, and I think these apps for your telephone did not exist when you came out with your first version, but now you can get apps to help you identify bird calls. Have you had much experience with these?
We have, to some extent.
Well, yeah, I've got a couple of them. I just listen to bird calls. I haven't used the ones that supposedly identify bird calls, which I find I'm going to have to try that because birds have individual voices and birds have individual accents. So birds from here, if you find them back east, say the song sparrow, have different accents, just like a New York accent or, you know, towhee here and a towhee there. So just like, you know, I was down south in Florida last week and people talked very differently than they do here. And birds do the same thing. We just don't key in on it.
So, for a while there was quite a bit of, for example, if you'd go out with a bird guide, they would use this the bird call as a way of drawing the birds in, so the people who are on this walk, on this guided walk, would be able to see the birds. But now they're finding that actually can be fairly upsetting to the birds. Because the calls could be, you know, we don't know what they're saying. They might be saying something like, I'm coming into your territory and I'm going to eat you or something.
So you may be sending a false message without knowing it.
Yes, or an upsetting message in some way.
Yeah. They discourage people from trying to get birds out of their little hiding places by using their songs. I think the ones you're referring to are just identifying songs.
Yeah, right. These apps, they're apps like Song Sleuth and Chirp-O-Matic and Birdsong ID, and they just help you identify.
Chirp-O-Matic sounds like something they'd sell at the state fair.
I know, and a sleuth, I don't know.
Yeah, but the reviewers say that
pretty accurate.
That there are. And that's pretty amazing that we have this, those of us who don't know bird calls have this resource.
Oh, I know.
Yeah, I think if they work, it would be pretty amazing.
Pretty amazing, yeah. And who is the guy that you worked with who could tell individual birds?
A guy at Cal Academy of Sciences, he had passed away a couple of years ago. He could identify individual birds, and he could even identify their offspring. He knew who the parents were by the song of the young one.
Because the parents sort of teach their children to, you know,
Yeah, people might wonder if, well, birds are born with these songs, knowing these songs, but you're just saying they learn.
Yes, they do, very much so. And so birds that have been sort of separated from, you know, where they might learn their call will not have it. So I think, Roger,
birds are the basics of their song, or that they're born with the basics of their song, instinctive. But they don't really refine it until the next year when they start hearing the adults who have used the song before, and then they refine their songs based upon the adults. So if you put birds in captivity and don't let them hear the adults, but you let them hear, say, a canary or something, they change their song. So they'll be partly instinctive and partly learned, but the learned part might be a canary.
So if you have a canary in your house, you wouldn't probably have these other wild birds, but if the bird is overhearing a canary and he's not a canary, he might just sound like one, pick up the accent of a canary.
Well, he'll pick up part of it, yes.
Sure. And, of course, they for a while, there was a big business in training canaries to sing different kinds of songs, that whole Hart's Mountain. I don't know if you remember the Hart's Mountain people, but they had a show, you know, and they had the birds singing all these, I don't know. What was that, Raj?
Yeah, Sunday mornings, they'd have play classical music and have this canary sing along with it. You can still get the record. You can find it on YouTube or someplace. And then it was very popular. People would buy canaries based on that. And then the unscrupulous pet shops would inject female canaries with male hormones, so they would sing at least for a couple of months.
And then they'd stop because
then they quit singing.
Yeah, because they ran out of the hormones. So it's yes, I know it's sort of the downside, I guess, of being beautiful and having a lovely call is that you know then people want to cage you and have you available for their pleasure and that's not what Bidwell Park is about.
Mockingbirds were sold as cage birds in New York in the 1800s or in the 1800s, right?
You lecture on cruise ships, and that must be somewhat of an adventure. What parts of the world have you seen when you traveled and enlightened the crews, the people on the cruise about
it's
birds?
Like what part haven't we seen?
Yeah, no, we've seen
quite a bit.
Quite a bit on ships, yes. I mean, Africa and Asia.
Both sides of Africa.
Both sides of Africa and, of course.
There's a lot of instability in some of these African countries.
People cruise is because they can tiptoe onto the shore and say they've been there and they get back on and have a cocktail or whatever. I mean, cruising is definitely travel light, I would say, and you're not having to deal with
You're giving these lectures, do you pick birds that they're likely to see if, in fact, they get off the ship?
Oh, right.
Absolutely.
Birds of Africa or birds of the ocean or something like that, seabirds.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we went up from England up Norway into Spitsbergen and that area. And, you see a lot of seabirds along a route like that, but also South America and the Amazon. It's very exciting for birds, very exciting.
My guests are ornithologist and author Roger Lederer and author and illustrator Carol Burr. And they collaborated on a new edition, an expanded edition of their book, The Birds of Bidwell Park. What was the motivation for doing a new edition? That's a lot of work.
Well, and we didn't want to do it. We did 2,000 copies of the first one. We did 1,000 and then we ran out. And so we did another printing of 1,000 and we thought, that's enough. And then we start getting calls from Maiden Chico, Bird in Hand, ABC Books, places that carry our books. And he said, we haven't got any more. No, we don't have any more. And then we talked to Bob Maloney of Bird in Hand, and he said, you have to put out another copy. He said, this is a classic Chico book. And I don't know what a classic Chico book is, but he sort of convinced us, yeah, why not? Let's expand it and let's, give it another go over and see what we need to do, maybe polish things a little bit. And I think that actually the quality of this book is even higher.
Yeah.
The cover's a little bit thicker and it folds.
It opens up more easily.
And flattens out a little bit easier. So the quality of the paper is good. And we didn't change a lot of the writing, but Carol made me move a lot of periods. From outside the quote marks to inside the quote marks.
He was being British. I told him to stop.
And she caught things like I'd use, different tenses in the same paragraph or plural and singular in the same paragraph. And so we cleaned some of that kind of stuff up.
Yeah.
And then Larry Jackson with the Heidelberg Printing was really good, and he'd point this out because not being a bird watcher, not being familiar with the book, what about this, what about that? Mm-hmm. So
he came at it with a beginner's eyes.
Yes.
To ask you,
yes.
Have you explained things that it might not have occurred to you, who know birds so well, to explain to a new bird watcher?
Right.
Yeah.
Novice bird watcher. We were talking about the fact that these various birds have their own personalities. And, for example, there are some birds that steal from other birds. And I'm thinking about the coot. Which is also mud hen. I can't help but chuckle at some of the names of these birds, but you say that they steal from other coots.
Well, a lot of birds do that. Penguins steal from each other. They steal nesting materials. They'll steal food. Birds are a little bit like us in that way. There's resources are limited, and natural selection says whoever gets the most amount of resource, no matter how, is the one who wins. So it happens more often than we think.
Well, tell her about the cowbird. I think that's a great example of a kind of stealing.
Well, a cowbird lays its eggs in other birds' nests. It can do it. Most birds will take 5 or 10 seconds to lay an egg. They can lay an egg in 2 seconds. They'll run over to a bird's nest, and the bird leaves and leaves
the bird whose nest it
the bird whose
to.
Nest it is leaves to go get some food for the young ones, and their cowbird flies in, lays an egg in 2 seconds, and is gone. And next day, lays its egg somewhere else and is gone, and so on. And so, and then the bird that's raising these eggs and young wonders why its young is twice the size it's supposed to be. But they're pretty successful doing that, but they don't do enough of it that they're endangering any birds.
Well, and you said one bird had figured out a way to counter, kind of recognize the egg as being foreign and kicked it out of the nest.
Yeah, there's a European cuckoo. We know our cuckoos don't do it here, but European cuckoos match the eggs and the young markings of the mouth when they gape and beg look just like the parents. I mean, look just like the parents would expect. But some will recognize the cuckoo egg as being a cuckoo egg and throw it out.
So we see, you know, just like humans, sometimes you get outsmarted.
Yeah, because I would think the mother bird would just come sit down on the eggs and not realize that she had an interloper.
Pretty much that's what happens, yes, except that, you know, you see a nest, you see a photograph of a nest, and there'll be all these little birds, and then there'll be this big bird, and you're thinking, haven't you noticed that this bird is twice the size of your other offspring here? Yeah.
Well, another thing that surprised me, too, and the poor coot in this case, is that I assume that birds did not eat other birds. I don't know why I thought that, but I assume, well, cats eat birds and they have predators like that. But you say bald eagles eat coots.
Bald eagles will pick on coots once in a while. Bald eagles will also, you know, chase osprey for their
fish.
They tend to be more scavengers or anything else, but they'll also go after coots because coots are easy. They don't fly very well. They're pretty dumpy, you know. They're easy to get to. So, so they'll eat those too, anything easy.
Easy prey, yeah. Easy victim.
Up in Alaska, you find bald eagles all over the dumps, just like we find crows and gulls here. We find bald eagles up there because there are no vultures up in Alaska, so they take the place of vultures.
Yeah.
I think of a bald eagle as being too dignified for that.
That's what you would think.
That's only because of its symbolism, not its behavior.
Right.
Yes. Yeah.
Actually, Ben Franklin wanted a turkey to be our national symbol.
That. Yeah.
Because and he mentioned these things about the bald eagle. So they're not really nice. They steal and they, you know, eat garbage and all that kind of stuff. Let's use the turkey. But he got outvoted.
Yeah.
Well, some of these characters, I say characters because are good actors. You say that the killdeer, this shorebird, will pretend he has a broken wing and hobble along like he has a broken wing or a broken leg. Why would he do that?
Well, because then the predator would go after him instead of after the egg. And they do that in England, too. There's a bird that looks a lot like this killdeer. It's called a lapwing for the same reason, because they flap their wings on the ground. Like they're lapping them on the ground, I guess. So lapwings do it.
Yeah, so acting wounded, like, come to me, I'm a weaker.
Don't attack the babies or the
right,
eggs.
Exactly.
Attack me, because I'm already limping around.
Right,
I'm
right,
easy.
Right.
That's exactly
I'm an easy
right.
victim.
Yes.
Yeah.
It's very clever.
They're playing possum, sort of.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. You could view it that way. Then the red-tailed hawk, you say, was once called a chicken hawk, and it's a symbol in Native American culture. And how do Native Americans use the red-tailed hawk feathers?
Well, they use them on these, what do they call the chest direct?
Chest plate.
Things like that. They use flicker feathers and red tail feathers and those kinds, just for decoration. Bald eagle feathers they use for their headdresses.
Oh, yeah.
But feathers are really common in lots of native cultures all around the world and have been for years.
I never thought about what kind of feathers they use, but there are specific feathers that they use.
For different kinds of things. I'm not all that familiar with exactly what's used for what, but
yeah.
Except for the bald eagle feathers for the headdress.
Very much so, the bigger feathers, yeah.
Well, then another hawk, the red shoulder, I mentioned the red-tailed hawk, the red shoulder hawk, you say the eggs hatch in such a way that the youngest might starve.
That's true with all hawks, because it's called asynchronous hatching, because if there's not enough food, so there's three babies in a nest and they hatch one day and then 2 days later and 3 days, 4 days later, then you get a big one, small one, a big one, medium-sized one, and a small one. If there's not enough food, the small one dies. If there's enough food, they all live. So it's a way of dealing with unpredictable food shortages.
And yet you still have a bird that can survive that the Brewer's Blackbird is one that has an interesting way of, this is my interpretation now, of landing maybe like an airplane. And I tried to figure out how this was describing how the wind blows and he turns to land into the wind. Understanding
well, a lot of birds do that. It depends on their wing structure. But if you watch them, yeah, they're very good at dealing with the wind and moving their wings in and out and opening their feathers up at the ends of their wings so they get more lift or less lift. Well, an airplane can't do that. Airplane just has to deal with it, especially has to land on a runway. Birds can land in any direction. But if they get really gusty winds, especially if you're a small bird, you have to be pretty agile.
Yeah, and the thing I find interesting is that birds sometimes use less energy flying than they would landing and taking off. So for the birds that have to cover great distances when they're migrating and sometimes cannot land because they're over ocean or whatever, mm-hmm. I mean, they have figured out a way to actually conserve their energy in flight, which I think is quite extraordinary. So another, you know, the survival technique.
Well, now you mentioned migrating birds, but do migrating birds make a stop in Bidwell Park?
Oh, yes. Oh, sure. Yeah, a lot of them do. Some of the warblers on their way south will stop. Anything that needs a little bit of food, you know, will stop there.
And the paper today, the Enterprise Record, had the snow goose. There was all kinds of
geese and shorebirds.
The geese are really showing up, and they had a wonderful, you know, photograph of the snow geese coming in, going south, heading south.
But making a stop in Bidwell Park.
Not as much in Bidwell Park as
that's
in,
what I was. I didn't think.
No,
Lana
and Seiko and other. You know, a lot of them do come through.
If you see an osprey in Bidwell Park, it'll be at Horseshoe Lake during migration. Mm-hmm. Other birds are only found, you know, in the winter, like larksparrows. So every year we give a couple walks for the Snow Goose Festival. I know exactly where I'm going to find larksparrows that day. They're all in the same place every year.
Yeah. That, too, is amazing that their, I guess you call it instincts, guide them in such a way to be that accurate.
They have a great GPS.
Well, I found it interesting. You said a flycatcher beats an insect body on a branch. And first of all, some birds can actually catch an insect in flight, you say.
Mm-hmm.
And then this flycatcher, as his name applies, he can catch a fly. Why would he beat the insect on a branch?
Same reason you open a peanut shell before you eat the peanut. It's too hard. The beetles especially are too hard, so they just break the wings off or smash them up in little pieces so they can eat them. But they can. One of my first research projects in graduate school was there was the idea that birds had little whiskers on either side of their mouth. And so the whiskers would act as a net, and the birds would snap on the fly as they went by. And I thought, I'm not sure about that. So I captured some birds, put them in a big cage, and I took high-speed motion pictures, 400 frames a second. And I fed them flies. I blew flies through a little hole, and they'd go after the flies, and I took pictures. They don't use those those little whiskers at all, but they catch them at the end of their bill. Their bill moves very fast, and it's got a little hook at the end. And it turns out the little whiskers on either side of their face are used for speed detection direction.
So navigation.
they know they're moving right, they're moving left, they're going fast, they're going slow, they're going up, they're going down. It's sort of like cat's whiskers.
Uh-huh.
Right. Proprioception.
Well, now, there are some birds that I thought of squirrels when I read this in your book. Because squirrels this time of year are really busy. All I have to do is look out my kitchen window and I see squirrels busily burying acorns. And there are birds that do this.
Nutcrackers, especially. Well, scrub jays do
scrub
it too.
Jays too.
But nutcrackers, they've done the most research on nutcrackers. You know, we have some nutcrackers here and then there's one in Europe as well. They'll bury acorns and they can find them with 95% accuracy, even under 3 feet of snow.
Really
so
quite.
They just have they memorize the picture, apparently, of the trees and the bushes and whatever is there. And they know exactly where it is. And they also know how many nuts they put in a particular place. So if it's really cold and they need a lot of food, they go to the ones with the biggest cache with the biggest nuts and biggest number of nuts in it.
Yeah. Yeah, and tell them about what happens to the jays when they, you know, they think that somebody's been watching them bury their
egg. With the jays. The jays will bury a nut, but if they see another jay watching them, they'll come back and move the nut.
Because the jays will steal acorns from other scrub jays.
They'll only move the nut if they themselves are a burglar.
Professor Lederer, I would like to ask you the effect of humans on birds in their lives. You have a chapter in your book, Beaks, Bones, and Bird Songs. Your last chapter is What We Do to Birds. And birds that live in cities, there's one advantage that you mentioned, and that is that if a cat is after a bird, then in a city, the bird has more places to hide. But for the most part, we humans don't always have a very beneficial influence on birds. How so?
Well, no. I mean, we've done all kinds of things with the birds, with pesticides and pollution and traffic and usurping their habitat and global warming and power lines and windmills, you name it. You know, we're decimating birds. There's probably, in North America at least, is a 40% reduction in absolute number of birds over the last 40 or 50 years, and worldwide, the numbers are about the same. Now, some birds have adjusted to the cities to a certain extent, but these are fairly rare birds, especially big cities. We've got pigeons and starlings and house sparrows and crows that are used to eating almost anything and getting used to people. But you don't find warblers and you don't find flycatchers and other kinds of birds like that that really need their native habitat.
Destroying their habitats by building highways and cities.
We're just too many people now. I mean, seven and a half billion people on the earth. That's twice as many as when I was born. So we've got to put them somewhere, and then we have to feed them. We have to get room for their transportation. We have to produce supplies for them, and that's all using up the resources that birds used to use.
Well, what effect does noise have on birds?
Depends on the bird. Some birds sort of get used to it. Some birds don't have a problem with it. There's actually a martin colony down in Manaus, Brazil, that nests in an oil refinery, or they winter in an oil refinery. It's extremely noisy. Somehow it doesn't seem to bother them. But other birds will just disappear because they can't communicate, especially songbirds. They just can't communicate with their songs. Some have adjusted a little bit. White-crowned sparrows in San Francisco sing. But during rush hour, when it's really busy, they drop out the lower parts of their lower pitches of their song, because the lower pitches is what traffic noise makes. So they just use the higher pitches. But when
so they just raise their pitch when the noise level goes up.
Well, they don't raise their pitch. They just drop out that part of the song. Their song goes from a low pitch to a high pitch, and they drop out the low pitch part and sing only the high pitches. But when rush hour goes away and traffic is lower again, then they use their whole song.
Well, what about pesticides? Are we getting better about that or not, about the use of pesticides?
Well, I think we're getting a little smarter about pesticides. We're making pesticides that aren't quite as bad. We don't spread them out quite as frequently. There's still a major problem, especially in undeveloped countries where they're using all kinds of pesticides.
For example, if a chemical company here in the United States can no longer sell to Americans because we're getting wise to that, they go off to another country and sell their product to third world or less developed countries.
Right. I mean, it varies all over the world. There's an antibiotic. This is not a pesticide, but it's an antibiotic used in cows in India. Diclofenac, I think it's called. The cows eat. Cows use the antibiotic, but when they die, since the Indians don't eat cows, they just are left to the vultures. But this diclofenac is fatal to vultures, and so the vulture population has dropped from tens of millions to a few hundred thousand over the last 20 years.
Because of the use of this chemical.
Yes.
Yeah. In the case of birds who might be eaten by cats, it might be advantageous to live in a city if you're a bird that a cat would want to eat.
Well, cats are probably one of the biggest predators on birds. Well, they certainly are the biggest predator on birds in North America. That's hundreds of millions, perhaps a billion birds are killed by cats every year in North America. The only thing that comes close is windows. Birds run into windows. Cats are first or second, depending on, you know, what statistics you have. In the city, birds get used to cats, and they also have a lot more places to hide, that is, the birds do. And of course, they have, you know, 20 stories. They can fly up and sit on a ledge that cats can't get on. But birds or cats, as much as I like cats, and I've had several, are a real scourge on birds.
Well, you mentioned the windows, and that always makes me sad. I've occasionally seen birds that have flown into a window, and it makes me sad. Are we doing anything architecturally about these huge high-rises?
Yes, some. Some cities, Boston, San Francisco, Chicago, have what they call a bird-safe ordinance, and they have to build buildings and windows in such a way they minimize bird strikes. I was a little disappointed to see this new theater building they put on campus because it's going to be a bird trap. They couldn't have built it worse. It's just, it's all glass, and in front of it are trees, and that's what happens. Birds see the trees, they see the reflection of the trees, they think it's all open, and they run right into it. Luckily, it's sort of down in a valley that it's in a lower area, lacks an auditorium, and a couple other buildings are around it, so birds aren't likely to dip down and go into it. Where there are no other buildings there, it would be a real mess. So I'm waiting to see what happens. I'm going to go look over there every couple of weeks during migration, see how many dead birds there are.
Oh, my.
Because the people who find the most dead birds are janitors when they're cleaning up outside around San Francisco. So if you want to find out what's happening to birds and bird buildings, is to talk to the janitors. But there are ways to minimize that, and one of which is a glass which has UV stripes in it. So birds see the UV. We can't, so the glass looks fine to us. But the birds can see the UV, and so they don't run into it. Another way is to tip the glass at a 45-degree angle or 35-degree angle out. So if they hit it and put a shelf or put a ledge there, so if birds hit it, they fall to the ledge rather than falling five stories to the ground. It maybe give them some time to recover. And they also don't hit it straight on. They hit it at an angle.
So I think the more we know about birds, the better stewards we can be on this planet that we share with these.
One thing is knowing. The second thing is having the money and the political will
to implement,
to implement it.
Well, you've certainly piqued our curiosity about the birds that we can observe here locally. Thank you so much, Roger Lederer.
Thank you.
And Carol Burr.
Thank you.
And their expanded version of the Birds of Bidwell Park. You can find this and other episodes of Nancy's Bookshelf on our website, mynspr.org. I'm Nancy Wigman.
You've been listening to Nancy's Bookshelf. Our theme music is The Mysterious Barricades by Francois Couperin, performed by Warren Haskell. Nancy's Bookshelf is a production of North State Public Radio.